be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tierre has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a complaint has been filed against Republican gubernatorial candidate Kevin Mannix for some 16 deficiencies in his finance report.
Guantanamo Bay may release two Chinese prisoners, and in our newscast tonight, hear a live interview with James Yi, a Muslim chaplain at the prison.
Pope Benedict XVI speaks out strongly against torture under any circumstances.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,150 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 42,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 30,892 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 13th. I'm Jamie Heim.
I'm Lori Hilliard. State elections officials are looking into Republican governor candidate Kevin Mannix's campaign finance reports after a complaint from injured worker advocate Ernie Delmazzo. Delmazzo filed a complaint with the Elections Division last week, claiming 16 deficiencies in Mannix's September campaign finance report. He seeks an audit of the report. He alleges that Mannix filed one report citing a $45,000 loan from himself to his campaign, then filed another report listing the money not as a loan, but as a direct contribution. At least four other alleged problems stem from money or in-kind services contributed by Mannix's Salem law firm to his campaign.
Ranchers in central Oregon are sweating over a steady decline in area ponds for their thirsty livestock. The problem stems from a canal wall that failed last month. It sent water meant to replenish ponds flooding into a residential neighborhood in Bend. Officials say repairs and reinforcement to the canal will not be complete until later this month. The canal feeds more than 2,000 different locations in southeast Bend, Alfalfa, and Powell Butte. Although ranchers can rely on well water, they say it's just not enough when their herds number in the hundreds or even thousands. Because of the canal breach, many ranchers have not received water since the end of irrigation season in mid-October.
The state attorney general is signing a multi-million dollar lease for new office space in Seattle. But Attorney General Rob McKenna says the deal will save taxpayers a bundle of money. The new lease for McKenna's Seattle office lasts 10 years, with a total rent of $27.5 million. But McKenna says that lease saves about $12.5 million over the current arrangement. The Seattle office will occupy at 115,000 square feet in the Bank of America Fifth Avenue Plaza. The State Department of General Administration negotiated the new lease.
The Clark County Health Department says they have confirmed six cases of E. coli in young people between the ages of 5 and 19. According to a doctor with the Clark County Health Department, two of the children are in unstable condition. Officials say that five drank unpasteurized milk brought in from D. Creek Dairy in Longview, Washington. Now, doctors are urging anyone who may have consumed unpasteurized milk in the past 10 days or who have bloody diarrhea to seek medical attention. Doctors also say to wash your hands after handling livestock and preparing food, cook your meat thoroughly, and only consume pasteurized milk products.
State and local courts rejected last-minute appeals filed by lawyers on behalf of San Quentin death row inmate Stan Tookie Williams. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger denied clemency, paving the way for Williams' execution, who was pronounced dead at 12:35 this morning. Williams' supporters say new evidence proving his innocence continues to emerge every day, evidence they say indicates the state executed an innocent man. Free Speech Radio News' Sarah Olson has more from inside San Quentin Prison.
The state of California executed Stantucky Williams this morning despite two last-minute requests for the governor to stay the execution and thousands of demonstrators outside the prison walls. Williams' arm was prepared with two IV needles. One was used to inject Williams with three chemicals. The first chemical sedated him, the second stopped his breathing, and the third stopped his heart. Steve Ornosky is the warden at San Quentin State Prison.
Stanley Williams spent his last day visiting with his legal team. He was calm and maintained his composure throughout the day, even when learning that clemency had been denied. He was executed by lethal injection shortly after midnight. He was pronounced dead at 0035 military time.
After Williams was pronounced dead at 12:35 a.m., supporters in the witness area shouted, "The state of California has just executed an innocent man." Those close to him say Williams was serene throughout the day. Reverend Jesse Jackson was with Williams when he heard that California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger denied him clemency.
I met with Cooker earlier today. We said, "I feel good. I've been in the valleys and shadows of death before. I've had bullets whizzing by my head, and I feel really that it's not so much what I'm accused of that's on trial, but my relationship with the Crips that's on trial."
Inside the prison, over 2,000 demonstrators gathered to protest Williams' execution. Many see what they say is insufficient evidence during the trial and the court's failure to hear new evidence that has emerged as recently as Saturday as an indication that California was rushing to execute Williams. Crystal Bybee is with the Save Tookie Coalition in San Francisco.
It will go down in history as a shameful day at the very time that California was at the crossroads of what I think will be the end of the death penalty, at a time when more and more people are coming out against the death penalty, more and more issues are coming to light.
In fact, California will be reviewing the death penalty with regards to how it's applied to poor people and people of color. In addition, State Assembly member Mark Leno has authored new legislation asking for a moratorium on the death penalty in California. It will be considered in January. In light of these developments, the question on everyone's mind last night was, why rush to execute Williams? Demonstrators against the death penalty also said that justice would never be served by an execution. Daryl Meyer's son was murdered nearly a decade ago. He's been speaking against the death penalty ever since and says our current criminal justice system is simply not good enough.
If we want to end this kind of violence, we need to take responsibility for the children who are abused and abandoned, neglected, punished to the point of them wanting to hurt other human beings.
Elizabeth Terzakis is with Campaign to End the Death Penalty. She says it's important not to forget the legacy of nonviolent work Williams' life has come to symbolize for many at-risk youth. She finds it unacceptable that California would choose to execute someone who's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and someone who's been a role model for kids that no one else took the time to mentor. However, she says, Williams left behind a powerful body of work.
We will continue to carry his spirit with us, and we will continue to fight against racism and justice tomorrow and the next day and the day after that, because that's, I think, what Sam wants.
For Free Speech Radio News at San Quentin State Prison, I'm Sarah Olson.
The Williams case set off a nationwide debate over the power of redemption. Hollywood stars and anti-death penalty advocates argue that Williams made amends by writing children's books about the dangers of gangs, and thus he was nominated for the Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize. Some 2,000 people rallied outside the gates of San Quentin during the state's highest profile execution in a generation. From California, Kelly Wilkinson has more.
The crowd was made up of anti-death penalty activists, religious leaders, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and young people who said Tookie Williams' life gave them hope. Leading up to the prison gate, a line of small candles flickered in the dark. The overwhelming theme among protesters was redemption and injustice. A man who only gave his name as Malcolm came from Oakland.
It's sad because this system is supposed to be to reform and redeem people. And here it is, we had a redeemed man who we're going to kill anyway.
The crowd was overwhelmingly pro-Williams, but there were two L.A. radio hosts who said they rejoiced in Tookie Williams' execution.
Tookie is not an icon. Tookie is nothing but a murderer.
Go home!
Williams supporters pushed close to drown out the dissenters. Closer to midnight, the mood among the demonstrators shifted to grim resignation. The crowd fell silent, and when it became apparent that the execution had been carried out, people struggled with the question of what next. Byron Williams lives in Oakland.
You know, now what? I mean, does it evolve into cynicism, or do the, you know, seeds of hope, you know, sprout up from this? That's going to be everybody's challenge who's out here tonight.
For the California Report, I'm Kelly Wilkinson at San Quentin.
Free Speech Radio news correspondents, including Andrew Stelzer and Renee Feltz, were on the streets of Tampa, Houston, and East L.A. last night, talking to people from all walks who expressed shock, anger, and sadness over Tookie's execution.
Well, actually, I'm really hurt and disappointed because it seems that our society's taking two steps backwards and thinking that when somebody kills, you're going to kill somebody who kills as a solution.
He probably changed and everything, but he killed four people, so he needs to die. He did something good, that's good. He tried to change his life, hopefully he found God, you know? Maybe he went to a better place if he did good.
When they take life so lightly, and when they overlook what's considered redemption, which you hear that word all through the Christian stuff in this country, and they take away a man that could potentially save thousands and thousands of lives, why destroy the investment? Why destroy the potential?
I'm not pro-death or anything like that, but in that particular case, I think the crime fit the punishment.
I don't think it's right. You know, first of all, he's in there for murder, right? So what, they're going to kill this guy? You know, it sort of defeats the whole purpose, you know. Okay, so he's in here for murder, so we're going to kill him. You know what I mean? That doesn't really sound right.
A lot of people reform when they go to prison. If he's guilty, you know, and unless somebody's seen him directly, you know, it's kind of like hard to say whether he's guilty or not. To me, I just hope that the law is doing what it needs to be doing, and that's the best we can do. Even Jesus Christ didn't deserve to die, but it happened.
Still to come on the Cable Evening News at 5:13, Tom DeLay has been associated with Cunningham and his misdeeds. Two Chinese prisoners may soon be released from Guantanamo, and hear a live interview with James Yee. He is the Muslim chaplain at the prison. Pope Benedict XVI speaks out strongly against torture under any circumstances. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
A federal judge is considering ordering the release of two Chinese Muslims held at Guantanamo Bay, which would be an unprecedented step in the legal battles surrounding the Bush administration's treatment of detainees. U.S. District Judge James Robertson raised the possibility 8 months after the U.S. military found the two men were not enemy combatants. A Justice Department lawyer told the judge at a hearing this week that the Bush administration is still trying to find a country that will take the men who say they fear torture or death if they are returned to China. Court papers in the case quote one of the detainees as saying, "We are going nuts here. Why are we still here? What kind of law exists in America to allow this to happen?" Last year, Robertson said the Bush administration's system of military commission trials for terror suspects from Guantanamo Bay is unlawful, and that the defendant's status as enemy combatants must first be determined by a competent tribunal. That issue is now before the Supreme Court.
West Point graduate Captain James Yee was a Muslim chaplain at the Guantanamo Bay prison when he was falsely accused of treason. After serving 2 months in solitary confinement, the military dropped all charges against him. Well, James is here in Portland this evening, and he joins us live on the phone. James, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me here today.
Now, you were a West Point graduate, but yet you were falsely accused by the U.S. Army of being a terrorist spy. Give us a rundown. Tell us what happened.
Yes, I was actually assigned to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for most of 2003 as the Muslim chaplain of that controversial prison camp in which at that time some 660 or so prisoners, all of the Muslim faith, were being held and caged in these cells. Today some 500 or so still remain there, most without charges and definitely without the benefits of due process. But I was the chaplain assigned to that operation, and I advised the command on this unique religious paradigm. And after making great contributions down there, coming back into the United States on September 10, 2003, I found myself arrested and being accused of espionage, spying, aiding the enemy, and essentially being threatened with the death penalty.
Did they tell you why they were charging you with all those?
Well, I was stopped by customs officials who made the claim that they found some suspicious documents, and then these suspicious documents were handed over to intelligence agents who then rendered them as classified documents. I was later to find out that it was the FBI who had specifically requested from the customs officials to single me out, identify me, and search me on that day, and it turned out not to be a random search, but actually these customs officials were acting at the request of the FBI. Once they claimed that these documents were classified, then I was arrested, thrown in jail for 76 days, locked away in isolation, and transported to a super maximum security prison in Charleston, South Carolina.
So ironic, you're a West Point graduate.
I'm a West Point graduate. I come from a family that's deeply rooted in the military. My younger brother is also a West Point graduate. My other younger brother is currently an Army doctor serving on active duty. And my father was drafted during World War II.
Now, you're no longer in the military, I take it. Can you tell us about some of the conditions? We hear so much about what's going on at Gitmo.
Well, when I was down there in 2003, the conditions were very difficult for the prisoners. It was very rough. And I was disturbed by a lot of what I saw down there. And as the chaplain, I was in a unique position to know the prisoners on a very personal level. And it was part of my job to provide recommendation and observation about prisoner treatment to the command, both individually and collectively. And I spoke with the prisoners. I listened to them as the chaplain. A good chaplain is a good listener. And I would relay the information to the chain of command about the complaints and the concerns that the prisoners had about how they were being mistreated and abused and about some of the things that they were being subjected to in the interrogations.
Do you have any confirmation? Have you ever had any actual observations of some of these abuses?
A lot of the abuses that I witnessed, for example, was when the prison guards would conduct what are technically called forced cell extractions, or what was known in Guantanamo as IRFings, an acronym IRF, Immediate Response Force, which was a team of 6 to 8 guards, which was dressed in riot gear, full riot gear, knee pads, shin guards, chest protectors, helmets, and riot gears. And this procedure was used to extract a prisoner forcibly from the cell when the prisoner wouldn't comply. Now, sometimes this is necessary for the sake of security or safety of either the prisoner himself or another service member. But what I observed is that this was occurring for what I thought were relatively minor infractions, like, for example, having an extra styrofoam cup in the cell.
Sure. Now, what are some of the what are the prisoners saying when they talk to you? Did they have any message, shall we say, for America?
Again, what was that?
Was there any underlying message that some of these inmates at Gitmo had for America?
Well, actually, when I spoke with the prisoners and listened to them, what their most often complaint was how they were being treated because of their faith, their religious faith, mm-hmm. being a Muslim. There was a strong anti-Muslim hostility down in Guantanamo. And, of course, they often complained about how the Quran was being abused and mistreated. And, of course, earlier this year we heard the alleged reports from Newsweek indicating the Quran desecration. And from my personal experience down in Guantanamo, there was Quran desecration down at Gitmo, and the guards often abused the holy book.
So much to talk about. Now, you've been on a tour around the country with your new book, For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. And you're going to be in town tonight. What kind of response, quickly, we're running out of time, what kind of response have you had from the people on your tour?
Oh, this response has been overwhelmingly positive. People who have heard me speak or have read my story are utterly gripped about what happened to me. And many have apologized for what I had to go through, and many have thanked me for having the courage to stand up against injustices.
Well, James Yee, thank you so much for being with us. That's James Yee. He's a former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He'll be speaking this evening at the First Unitarian Church. That'll be at 7 p.m. That'll be at the corner of Southwest Main and 13th.
On today's segment of Eugene Inform Radio Report, the Lane County Bus Project explores the naked truth about Oregon's progressive political future, and Willamette Valley activists have begun hunger strikes in support of the so-called enemy combatants being held without constitutional rights at Guantanamo Bay military base in Cuba.
Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin. On Tuesday, December 13th.
This is Inform Radio, progressive news and community affairs from Eugene, Corvallis, and Southern Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin. On Tuesday, December 13th at Cosmic Pizza, The Naked Truth is coming out to dance at the ballot measure Peep Show. Adam Petkin is the director of the Lane County Office of the Bus Project.
The ballot measure Peep Show is our first of what will be many monthly forums in Lane County for what we call Bus Project Present, part of the Oregon Bus Project, to help engage and educate voters in the political process.
Can you give me a sneak peek of the progressive ballot measures that are happening for 2006?
Lori Siegel from the 1,000 Friends of Oregon will be here to talk about land use planning. There will also be petitioners from ballot measures that address revenue for schools and other important public services. Smart Forestry will be there to talk about their ballot measure, as well as two election reform ballot measures, one of them being fair elections, the other being one ballot. It's going to be very interactive. Participants are going to be able to ask questions of the petitioners. Or
give people a quick synopsis of what the Bus Project is, please.
The Bus Project does three things. It drives votes, it drives buzz, and it drives new leaders. We were founded in the 2000 run around a mission to educate, engage, and elect. We basically want to make Oregon a progressive example of what a place can be like.
Are you working on the Oregon State Legislature and those seats that are coming up?
Yes. One of our primary roles, actually, is that we get together a bunch of volunteers and we bring some excitement to different swing districts around the state and canvass for progressive legislature candidates to bring a more progressive legislature.
Have you targeted any particular legislative seats so far?
So this next current election cycle, one of the things we'll do is look for progressive candidates and also look at what resources we have and what volunteers we've been able to bring in and assign where we're going to be going from there.
A group called Witness Against Torture has 25 people who have gone into Cuba and are marching towards Guantanamo Bay to support so-called enemy combatants, prisoners who are on hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay. I'm speaking with Mike McGuire, who is the spokesperson for Witness Against Torture.
It's a group of people that are used to doing works of mercy in the Christian tradition. If this was in the United States, there's no way that we wouldn't have a presence outside of the base. The obvious reason was we're not going there. It's a U.S. naval base on the island of Cuba, and travel between the U.S. and Cuba is highly restricted by the U.S. government. That's simply unacceptable that the U.S. would hide what's happening in Guantanamo, so we decided we're going to go down there and defy the U.S. ban on travel, have a presence outside of that base in favor of human dignity, since one of the objectives of the interrogations is the dehumanization and lack of dignity in the treatment of these detainees.
Could you describe to our listeners who is taking part in the Witness for Torture march and support?
The bulk of the marchers are associated with the Catholic Worker Movement, the Dorothy Day tradition. We have Eve Kelly, a Jesuit priest, Sister Anne Montgomery, who is a member of the Christian Peacemaker team. You might recognize that name because four of the Christian peacemakers in Iraq were kidnapped a little while ago and being held under the threat of execution currently in Iraq. There's also Frieda Berrigan, the daughter of Phil Berrigan and Elizabeth McAllister. Phil Berrigan is very widely known for his anti-war activism in the 60s and since then.
Could you describe the plan?
We hit the ground on Monday. We started walking. It's a 50-mile march from Santiago to the checkpoint at the Guantanamo Naval Base. We're spending 5 days marching. We expect to arrive as close to the base as we can get Monday the 12th, the day of our arrival there. And if we're not allowed in, we plan on having a vigil outside of the base. Several of the marchers at that point will take up a hunger strike in solidarity with the folks that have been on hunger strike since August.
People can contact Inform Radio at amy@informproductions.com.
A Texas prosecutor is seeking records from the bribery case of a California congressman as part of the investigation of former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. District Attorney Ronnie Earl issued subpoenas last Thursday for bank records of a defense contractor involved in the case of former Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham. The defense contractor, Perfect Wave, contributed $15,000 to a fundraising committee founded by DeLay. Now, DeLay was forced to step down as majority leader after being indicted on charges of conspiracy, to violate Texas election laws. A second grand jury indicted him on money laundering charges. Cunningham resigned in late November after pleading guilty to taking bribes to steer defense contractors to various companies.
President Bush is acknowledging that seniors face daunting choices on Medicare's new prescription drug benefit, but he's urging recipients to get help and not give up on the coverage. Enrollment for the plan began a month ago for coverage that kicks off in January. However, many seniors are having a hard time choosing among the different private plans being offered. During a visit to a retirement home in suburban Virginia, Bush urged seniors to seek assistance if they're confused. He says plenty's available, if not from family and friends, then from pharmacies, Medicare's website, or church groups.
Ben Bernanke is waiting in the wings at the White House. He's Alan Greenspan's successor. He just turned 52. As Greenspan's Federal Reserve was raising interest rates again, and still chairman of President Bush's Council of Economic Advisers. Greenspan is to retire at the end of next month, and the Senate is expected to approve Bernanke well before then.
Japan's government has given U.S. beef the go-ahead to enter the country, but that doesn't mean supermarkets are racing to stock up on American meat just yet. Japan's major supermarket chains expressed caution today, a day after the country's U.S. beef ban was eased. In response to yesterday's announcement, Congressman Greg Walden, an Oregon Republican, says it's terrific news for the hardworking individuals who produce safe and high-quality American beef. He says that includes the many family farmers and ranchers in southern Oregon. Japan slapped a ban on American beef imports in December of 2003 after the first case of mad cow disease was found in U.S. herds. Japanese consumers, however, may need some time to get over their mad cow jitters. A recent poll showed nearly 70% of the respondents were against resuming imports.
Newsday reports that 3 months after Hurricane Katrina ripped through the Gulf Coast, the fate of more than 1,300 children still remains unknown. In the evacuations after the New Orleans floods, families were scattered across 48 states. Those overseeing evacuations in their rush to clear people from the city often separated families as they pressed them onto buses, helicopters, and planes, which then went in different directions. The unit of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, made up of retired law enforcement officers from across the country, was activated immediately after the storm. Initially, they said just over 4,800 children were unaccounted for. Some of those still missing could be dead. Most of the children probably are safe, they say, but separated from relatives or guardians who, because of the haphazard evacuation, just can't find them.
Former President Gerald Ford is hospitalized for what his chief of staff called routine medical tests. Penny Circle says Ford, who's 92 years old, is suffering from a horrible cold and he still hasn't gotten over it. Ford was admitted to Eisenhower Medical Center in Rancho Mirage late last night and is expected to be released tomorrow. Circle says tests are scheduled each December and did not release other details.
Blacks are far more likely than whites to live in neighborhoods with the highest levels of air pollution. That's a finding from an Associated Press study of government data. The AP analysis of EPA figures finds that in 19 states, blacks were more than twice as likely as whites to live in areas where air pollution seems to pose the greatest health dangers. Nearly half of Missouri's blacks and just over half of the blacks in Kansas live in the 10% of their respective states' neighborhoods with the highest risk score. The data is based on census records cross-referenced with health risk measures based on industry emission reports, ratings of risks from each chemical, and the paths pollution follows. The analysis also found residents in neighborhoods with the highest pollution scores also tend to be more poor, less educated, and more often unemployed than those people living elsewhere.
The current time is 5:30, and now on today's Earthwatch report, there's a global market for recycled mercury, and that makes it extremely difficult to clean up this toxic metal.
Recycled mercury really gets around, and it can cause problems at its final destination. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Mercury is a unique metal. It takes a liquid form at room temperature, it conducts electricity as a vapor, and it bonds easily to other metals to create alloys. These qualities make mercury useful in thermometers, energy-efficient light bulbs, and dental fillings. But mercury is also extremely toxic. One scientist says the global market for it creates an enormous challenge to cleaning it up. Marcelo Vega is the chief technical advisor for the United Nations Global Mercury Project. He says the United States and the European Union have encouraged people and businesses to recycle mercury to keep it out of landfills. But Vega says a lot of that recycled mercury is later on the global market, and tons of it are exported every year to developing countries.
But the U.S. still exports about 300 tons of mercury. Where does mercury coming from? Well, we have mercury recycled from the lamps, you know, the fluorescent lamps. We have mercury from batteries. All the recycled mercury, U.S. and the European countries, they just send to developing countries.
Vega says it's legal to export mercury for certain uses, such as dentistry. But in many developing countries, the mercury is often used for something else entirely. For example, it's often used in small-scale gold mining. Miners use mercury to extract gold from other sediments, but in the process, it can pollute the environment and threaten human health. Vega says the global market for mercury needs to be regulated better to curb this kind of pollution. Last June, the European Union agreed to end its trade of mercury within the next 5 years. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
The current time is coming up on 5:33, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Have you noticed? George W., Dick Cheney, Dennis Hastert, and the entire gaggle of right-wing media blatherers have been foaming at the mouth more than usual recently. They have gone into full mad dog mode because many Democrats, independents, sane Republicans, and just plain citizens are calling for a timetable to withdraw our troops from Iraq. Such people are cut-and-run cowards, shout the Bushites. They are nervous Nellies wanting to abandon the Iraqi people who are counting on us to stay the course. It's a treasonous disservice to our troops and gives comfort to the enemy for any American even to discuss withdrawal, wails the Republican scorn machine. Woo! They should save some of that breath for breathing. They also might reflect on the fact that more than half of Americans now say, bring the troops home. So, are the Bushites saying that the majority of people are cut-and-run cowards? And shouldn't the mouth-foamers remember that dissent is not treason, but the essence of democracy? Here's something else the Bushite mad dogs might pay attention to. While they're trying to shut down any discussion here at home about a withdrawal timetable, guess who is openly discussing it? The Iraqis. At a recent 3-day gathering in Cairo of top Iraqi politicians, including Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds, the group signed a formal memorandum that declares the Iraqi people are looking forward to the day when foreign forces will leave Iraq. This diverse assembly of Iraqi political leaders, who rarely agree on anything, then demanded, quote, a withdrawal of foreign troops on a specific timetable. Amazingly, the people of Iraq are able to discuss and demand withdrawal without anyone in power accusing them of being treasonous, cut-and-run cowards. This is Jim Hightower saying, hey, Bush, Cheney, Hastert, and gang, if Iraqis can have a free and civil debate about deadline and timetables, why can't we?
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast, and then at 6 p.m. hear Out Loud. The guest is mental health professional Heather Loeffler, who will speak on healthy coping for the holidays. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, and at 7, Amanda's Jam Corner. Tonight's weather, mostly clear in the evening, then partly cloudy. Patchy freezing fog, lows 25 to 35 with a light wind.
Near the gorge, east winds 5 to 10 miles an hour, increasing to 15 to 25 miles an hour after midnight. And tomorrow, partly sunny in the morning, then mostly sunny. In the afternoon, patchy freezing fog in the morning away from the gorge, highs around 40. An air stagnation advisory is now in effect for the central Willamette Valley and Washington County. This advisory will be in effect until 10 a.m. Friday. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The sixth ministerial conference of the World Trade Organization opened today, ushering delegates from 149 countries. Meanwhile, demonstrators have taken to the streets of Hong Kong. Ngoc Nguyen files this report.
Thousands of protesters rallied and staged sit-ins today along a route lined with shopping malls and upscale boutiques. They marched from Hong Kong's Victoria Park to the convention center, which juts into Victoria Harbor and is flanked on three sides by water. Police and spectators lined the route of the mostly peaceful but exuberant parade. The largest contingent was made up of thousands of South Korean farmers. Dozens of them surprised the crowd by stripping down to their boxer shorts, strapping on orange life jackets, and jumping into the frigid waters. They swam toward the convention center but were warded off by police in tugboats. In a separate incident, police pepper sprayed several activists who pushed up against police barricades. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ngoc Nguyen in Hong Kong.
The sixth World Trade Organization Ministerial Conference has kicked off in Hong Kong, China today. Many observers believe it's crucial that the WTO manage to resolve some of the sticking points holding up trade talks between economically developing and already industrialized nations. A major issue is the debate over free and fair trade. Many in the economically developing world believe that market liberalization in the name of free trade has impoverished local producers on account of the industrialized world's continued use of agricultural subsidies. Rupert Cook reports.
A weekday market in a small rural town in the Philippines. At first glance, it might appear that there's little connection between this predominantly agricultural community and current World Trade Organization negotiations. While the skyscrapers and conference halls of Hong Kong certainly do seem a world away from the Philippine countryside, the outcome of WTO trade talks could well have a significant impact on countless rural communities across the globe. A major point of dispute is the continued use of subsidies by the European Union, the USA and Japan to support their farming sectors. Many claim that such agricultural subsidies are effectively decimating the agricultural sector in developing countries. Father Shay Cullen runs Prada, a Philippine NGO which works to achieve social justice for oppressed or marginalized communities.
Poverty is coming about because unjust trade policies in the north. Nobody can compete. They're manipulating all the rules to make sure that all the goods that's manufactured in the north, in the rich countries, have complete access to the south and are sold in these poor countries. But our products coming from here, there's more protectionism in the north. And this is what's unfair trade. And this is what's causing poverty.
Several oceans and thousands of kilometers from the Philippines, children practice their singing in a primary school in Chifo Hamang, Lower Denkira District, a primarily rural area of central Ghana. With 70% of Ghanaians dependent upon farming, an influx of imported foodstuffs is undercutting local production. Ghanaian poultry farmers are going out of business thanks to cheaper chicken, imported from Europe. Low-cost American rice, known locally as Uncle Ben's, is also threatening the livelihoods of the country's rice producers. But while the government recognizes that liberalization may have gone too far, there's also a reluctance to call for the return of tariffs. Abraham Duma Odum represents Chifo Hamang on behalf of Ghana's ruling political party in the National Parliament.
Liberalization can go too far, but we're dealing with donor partners, we're dealing with World Bank, we're dealing with IMF. That is why I really don't believe in maybe using restrictions. The positive approach is make sure you do a good campaign about your local produce. We do good rice here, very nutritious rice, but the people don't know it and they prefer Uncle Ben's. If we are able to do the good rice, make sure that they are aware, then you can as well imagine the patronage. In that case, we'll use a positive approach to solve that subsidy problem.
The reluctance among Ghanaian politicians to challenge the status quo is closely linked to the fact that in recent years, donors have substantially increased their levels of aid to Ghana. There's a belief that the funds would dry up if the government were to deviate from the economic orthodoxy. Yet outside observers are calling for some form of tariff system to protect Ghana's increasingly impoverished rural population. Anja Kuhn is a technical advisor to German Overseas Development Agency, GTZ. She specializes in rural development in Ghana.
The imported products are often much cheaper than the products produced here in the country. So I think something should be done in case or in direction of import taxes or something like that. On the long run, I think without these import taxes, no Ghanaian products can really survive on the long run.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Chifohemang, Ghana.
Pope Benedict XVI's top official for justice issues says that torture is unacceptable for extracting information, even that which might thwart a terrorist attack. In analyzing what causes terrorism, the Pope said in the Vatican's annual review of world conflicts that, quote, consideration should be given not only to its political and social causes, but also to its deeper cultural, religious, and ideological motivations, end quote. The Pope also issued a warning about fundamentalism, saying that religious fanaticism, today often labeled fundamentalism, can inspire and even encourage terrorist thinking and activity. At a news conference about the peace message, Cardinal Ratano Martino, who heads the Vatican's Council on Peace and Justice, says that the Church does not allow torture as a means to extract the truth. Terror suspects sometimes say what the torturers want to hear. There are other ways, he says, to obtain the truth.
Swiss Senator Dick Marty, who is investigating allegations that the CIA kidnapped and illegally shipped terror suspects through European borders, has announced that the claims are likely true. In a report issued by a Council of Europe committee, Marty has condemned the U.S. for neither confirming nor denying the claims. Meanwhile, the Polish Prime Minister has commissioned a separate investigation into allegations that the CIA detained suspected terrorists at secret prisons in Poland. Results from that finding are expected as early as next week. Danuta Zafranić reports from Warsaw.
The American ABC television network has recently confirmed early allegations that captive terrorists, including the masterminds of the 9/11 attacks in New York, were being held by the CIA in secret prisons on Polish territory. According to ABC, at least a dozen names from among the top captured terrorists have been secretly brought to Poland by the CIA and imprisoned at sites of former Soviet military bases. These allegations were followed by reports in Britain's Sunday Telegraph that the European Union had a deal with the US in which it allowed it to use secret locations in Central Europe as base for CIA interrogations. The allegations were supposedly based on talks between top EU and US officials held 2 years ago in Athens. According to the Sunday Telegraph, important details of this agreement have been removed from the minutes, a claim denied by the spokesman of the European Commission, Frieza Roskam-Ebing.
The conclusion drawn in the article in the Sunday Telegraph is simply completely wrong. It's a pity that they haven't waited for Monday to check with us what the actual facts were. There are no secret minutes of any meeting between the EU and the USA.
According to Human Rights Watch, the main CIA secret prison is based in Poland. Military expert Mark Garlasko told the mass circulation Gazeta Wyborcza Daily that at least 24 dangerous Al-Qaeda suspects were held there. The incoming president, Aleksander Kwaśniewski, who is due to step down later this month, has also denied that any secret jails were on Polish territory. Prime Minister Marcinkiewicz, in power since October, reiterated that he trusted that. Special Services Coordinator Zbigniew Wasserman says the matter will be investigated, but to date nothing could put the president's statement in doubt.
I have put questions to the heads of the respective intelligence services and special forces units, but we must remember that these matters cannot be discussed in public because of their very nature. However, so far, I must stress that nothing has been confirmed from the allegations made by the media.
American expert Andrew Tickle is with the Stratford Institute, which prepares world economic and political forecasts. Speaking for Polish radio, he stressed that Poland, being one of Washington's leading allies in Europe, could be a suspect.
Both Poland and Romania are two very staunch U.S. allies. when it comes to the war on terror. Both countries have sizable contingents operating in Iraq. They've always been very supportive of U.S. initiatives in this area. If it turns out that these facilities, these so-called black sites, are an operation, I would not be surprised.
Meanwhile, Poland's conservative government has drawn fire from the opposition for denying that the prisons existed and has launched an investigation due to growing media pressure. Poland's former defense minister, Bronisław Komorowski, agrees with that view.
Poland should conduct a serious examination in this case, not in the form of a parliamentary investigation, which will treat it as sensational news to be checked, but using all the tools accessible to the government. This should be done in order for Poland to say with a clear conscience to the opposition, either take a unanimous stand and defend the country, or we have checked the facts and nothing in these allegations has proven to be true.
The current controversy over alleged secret detention centers seems to continue, despite pledges by the U.S. that such events never took place in Poland. It will be interesting to see whether Poland comes up with anything substantial after the investigation. The allegations are also being investigated by the Council of Europe. EU Justice and Home Affairs Commissioner Franco Frattini warned that any of the 25 bloc nations found to have operated secret CIA prisons could have their EU voting rights suspended. In Warsaw, I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News.
A war crimes trial opened Tuesday for Milan Martić. He's a leader of Croatia's breakaway minority Serbs. Prosecutors accused the former policeman of hundreds of murders. Well, he said he'd been defending his people against Croatian atrocities. Martić is accused of offenses from 1991, that's the very beginning of the wars that broke up Yugoslavia, up until 1995, when the breakaway Serb region of Krajina was recaptured by Croatian forces. Martić is 51 and has been indicted by the UN Tribunal in July 1995, 2 months after he allegedly ordered the bombardment of Croatia's capital Zagreb with cluster bombs, which killed at least 9 people and wounded dozens more. Martić was captured and transferred to The Hague in May 2002. He faces 19 counts of murder, persecution, unlawful imprisonment, torture, and other crimes against humanity against non-Serbs. He's pleading innocent.
Tensions remain high in the West Bank as the Israeli army continues an incursion there. Manar Jabrin files this report.
Israeli army invaded Nablus today, firing rounds of live ammunition at dozens of houses and clashing with locals. One Nablus resident was killed and at least 20 were injured. 2 Israeli soldiers were injured after an explosive charge was hurled at their jeep. Chris, a humanitarian aide living in Nablus, described what happened today.
There were hundreds of children out on the streets, and when we got there, there was already live fire. There had been no gas, no rubber bullets, just straight to live fire.
At least 5 Palestinians were arrested today in the West Bank cities of Tul Karim and Salfit. The Israeli army briefly withdrew from the West Bank city of Jenin on Tuesday and removed the checkpoints which have been installed at its main entrances 3 days prior. The army reinvaded the city hours after its withdrawal. For FSR, and I am Manar Jibri.
Haitians angry about mass deportations from the neighboring Dominican Republic protested a visit by the Dominican President Leonel Fernandez. At yesterday's demonstration in Port-au-Prince, wake-up calls, Dietner Fernandez asked Haitian student Ernest Bolivar to describe the immigration policy of the Dominican Republic. He says it's racist because its government is organizing an attack against a minority, a community, the Haitians. The Dominican Republic is a much more affluent nation in comparison to its neighbor, which ranks as the poorest country in this hemisphere. Haitian police later broke up the demonstration with live gunfire.
Iraqis in 15 countries begin voting today, with many who boycotted January's elections casting ballots for the first time. David Enders reports from Zarqa, Jordan.
Israeli army invaded Nablus today, firing rounds of live ammunition at dozens of houses and clashing with locals. One Nablus resident was killed and at least 20 were injured. Two Israeli soldiers were injured after an explosive charge was heard at their jeep. Chris, a humanitarian aide living in Nablus, described what happened today.
There were hundreds of children out on the street, and when we got there, there was already live fire. There had been no gas, no rubber bullets, just straight to live fire.
At least five Palestinians were arrested today in the West Bank cities of Tul Karem and Salfit. The Israeli army briefly withdrew from the West Bank city of Jenin on Tuesday and removed the checkpoints which have been installed at its main entrances 3 days prior. The army re-invaded the city hours after its withdrawal. For FSR, I am Manar Jibri.
2 years after his arrest, Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party still casts a shadow over Iraq's attempts to build a democracy, dividing politicians over whether former members ought to be allowed to run for parliament. Ahead of Thursday's vote, the commission in charge of purging senior Ba'ath members from public posts tried to get about 100 candidates barred from the race. When the Election Bureau declined to move against the candidates, the commission urged Iraqis not to vote for them. Those who believe former Ba'ath Party members should not be candidates argue that high-level members still have their eye on power. They say many, even those not directly involved in the regime's crimes, spied on neighbors and colleagues, informed dissidents, and contributed to the oppression of Shiites and Kurds. Others argue that purging Ba'athists smacks of an attempt to keep Sunni Arabs out of politics in the new Iraq, now dominated by the Shiite Muslim majority and the Kurds. They say excluding former Ba'athists deprives the country of expertise, increases Sunni alienation, and fuels the insurgency.
Zarqa, a suburb of Amman, has long hosted Iraqis who have come here to work in or purchase goods from the city's tax-free import zone. It is also the hometown of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the purported leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, one of the extremist groups that has threatened anyone participating in the Iraqi electoral process with death. More moderate resistance groups have responded to Al-Qaeda in Iraq by saying they will protect polling stations in the country when voting there takes place on Thursday. Moya Jessam Ebed is a truck driver from Mermadi, a city in western Iraq that continues to be a resistance stronghold and was the site of the assassination today of Mizher al-Dulaimi, a Sunni candidate in the election. Ebed said he boycotted January's polls because it was too dangerous to vote and that today he voted for Salah Mutluk, a secular Sunni candidate whose list is expected to compete for the Sunni vote with that of Adnan Dulaimi, a religious Sunni candidate and a member of the Association of Muslim Scholars. 15 members of Mutluk's list were purged by the Election Commission for having held too high a rank in the Ba'ath Party.
Saddam Hussein is much better than the Americans. They have been here 3 years, and they have done worse than Saddam has done.
Khalid Karim is from Heath, which in recent weeks has seen heavy fighting between guerrillas and the U.S. military and the new Iraqi army. He says he distrusts the current government, which is dominated by conservative Shiite parties, and that he also voted for Mutluk.
He represents Sunnis, and Sunnis are oppressed. They have accused Saddam of killing people, but they are doing much worse. This is why I am voting, so that there will be people in the government who represent us.
Though increased participation has been cited by some as a hopeful sign, no one expects resistance to the occupation to abate until U.S. troops leave the country. One man, who identified himself only as an exile of the new democracy, said he was also voting for the first time.
What brought me here are the American boots and the sectarian divide that is occurring in Iraq. The democratic terrorism. This election is to make people forget about the occupation and what is happening in Iraq.
Out of country voting for Iraqis continues tomorrow and Thursday. In Zarqa, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
And that is the Cable Evening News for Tuesday, December 13th, 2005. Any questions or comments? Please call us, 503-231-8032. And leave a message on extension 203. Or an email works, pmnews@kbu.org. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. And Corvallis 100.7 FM on translator K264AA. And in Hood River 91.9 on translator K220HR. Log on to the website, kbu.fm. Tonight's producer, Jim Thompson. Tonight's audio editor, Kate Welch. Our engineer is Eduardo de Lanteros Thierry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, and I'm Jamie Hine.
I'm Lori Hilliard. Stay tuned for Independent Native News, and coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Eduardo de Lanteros Thierry, guest host on Talk Radio. He and his guests will discuss the Palestinian wall and the wall at the U.S.-Mexico border and the connections between the two. At 9, it's Movie Talk with Ed, DK, and Dawn. At 10, Andrew Geller hosts People Rise Up. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your community radio station. Thanks for listening and have a good evening.
Good night.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 13th of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Three different laws protect bald eagles in the United States, but Alaska Natives have only been subject to one of these laws. Alaska had a bounty for eagle parts from 1917 until 1953, but as Chris Sharp reports, the laws may be hampering long-held traditions for some Alaska Native tribes.
Picking up eagle feathers or parts is not legal, according to Gary Moad, special agent in charge of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Eagle Repository in Commerce City, Colorado. Eagles are protected by three different laws. Moad says the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Endangered Species Act don't apply to Alaska Natives. But the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act does apply. Federally recognized tribes can obtain permits to own parts and feathers for ceremonial purposes. Feathers and parts that are found need to be sent to the National Eagle Repository in Commerce City, Colorado. Public Affairs Officer for the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife in Anchorage, Bruce Woods, says tribes can then apply to Colorado for a free permit, and the repository in Commerce City will then send the needed parts or feathers back to the tribe.
I can see why people up here where they see eagle feathers all over the place can't understand the law. There are tribes in other parts of the country for which the eagle is an equally totemic bird that don't have that kind of access.
Kasan resident and Tlingit Lance Twitchell agrees there should be some restrictions placed on eagle part use.
I know from experience, say something happens to an eagle, there's a bunch of people who just go and tear stuff off of it, you know, and there's no ceremony involved, there's no tradition involved. I would be all for monitoring the process more closely, but for Native people who have a tradition and ceremony in place, I don't think there needs to be any increased permitting there.
Haines and Klukwan share one of the largest, if not the largest, gathering places for bald eagles in the world, the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. Reporting from Haines, this is Chris Sharp.
The recent return of artifacts to a Minnesota tribe is keeping with a trend that is spreading nationwide. Randall Davidson reports.
The three birchbark rolls and six other sacred Ojibwe artifacts have been returned to the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa in Net Lake, Minnesota. With chants and a pipe ceremony, tribal elders reclaimed the objects earlier this month. The items had been in the American Museum of Natural History in New York. The Boys Fort Band has been working on getting its artifacts back for at least 2 years. A $9,100 federal grant this year helped accelerate the process. The federal government has been stepping up efforts to repatriate newly claimed cultural items from museums. At last count, more than 31,000 human remains and 724,000 artifacts have been returned to tribes around the country by 1,100 U.S. institutions. I'm Randall Davidson.
Well-known Cherokee hip-hop and rap artist Lightfoot is setting out on an ambitious tour to reach more than 200 reservations across the country. Jason Parr has more.
See, I guess that's where me and you just ain't gonna see eye to eye, because yeah, what you're saying is that things aren't ever gonna change for Indian people or for the reservation for our ancestors. I beg to differ with you.
With more than 10 albums already under his belt, Lightfoot, also known as Gary Paul Davis, will spend the next year traveling the country taking his message to reservations from Florida to Alaska. The 35-year-old Seattle-area resident believes that it's important to reach Native American youth and help fill their lives with hope. His Reach the Res tour already has significant support from several tribes, including a custom tour bus donated by the Seminole Tribe of Florida. Lightfoot, with a Cherokee tribal member, sees the tour as a chance to try and help Native American youth across the country through his words of motivation. Though his music can be as hard-edged as any contemporary rap being produced. In addition to the free concerts, there will also be a documentary film during the tour in hopes the message will continue beyond the travel. After starting on the East Coast last month, the tour is now working across the western U.S. and will finish next fall in Alaska. From Seattle, I'm Jason Parr.
The music in this piece was Revolution Train from Lightfoot's Revolution album, which won Best Hip-Hop Rap Album from the Indian Summer Music Awards. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's E-Edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.